ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Can you imagine the kind of letter you would write to your great-great-grandkids? 67 years ago, the ABC asked Australians to do just that, and...
Do you really live in a thing not much bigger than a couple of our phone boxes?
Perhaps you just press a button or twiddle a knob on some time machine and pop into any point in time and space you feel inclined to visit.
Clearly, they got a lot wrong. So why are we so bad at predicting the future? I'm Matt Bevan, and for If You're Listening, this is Black Swans, a series about the unpredictable moments that change the course of history.
Jez, I'm glad we're getting the chance to talk.
There is a bit to talk about this week.
Mate, I'm really pissed off.
Lots of people not covered in glory this week. Big names in the news.
There's individuals, and then there is a whole stinking system.
Yes.
In which hordes, thousands of women have been abused. Of course, we're talking about Epstein and the release of those files. Now, the reason that I'm pissed off, I think, is because so many people said, oh, I couldn't really tell there was anything going on. Oh, I just didn't know. Or sure, he'd had a sexual abuse conviction in Florida. But, you know, that was... I guess just explained away by him, by his lawyers. And so we all carried on. All of the world's most powerful men, academics, head of universities, the royal family, prominent politicians, just massaging each other's backs and
okay,
reputations.
Tell me about this. How much do you buy the reasoning that there is A, a lack of evidence on some of these allegations, and B, people's business are their own business. I just simply didn't know. Because that seems to me to be the core of the story is a lack of evidence with some of these allegations and the fact that people just didn't know.
All right, Jess, I've got a lot to say about that, but first I'm Julia Baird.
And I'm Jeremy Fernandez. We're in Sydney on Gadigal land, and this is Not Stupid, where we're talking about the big news of the week that's been in your feeds, plus the news that's kind of grabbing our attention
and
as well.
And blowing your brains.
You bet.
Okay, I want to talk about Melinda Gates because she just gave an interview, which I've just seen, on NPR. We have known that Bill Gates' relationship with Jeffrey Epstein was a factor in their marriage breaking up. We know that she was repulsed by Jeffrey Epstein. She said a couple of years ago, in 2022, that she met him exactly one time because she wanted to see who he was. She said, I regretted it the second I walked in the door. He was abhorrent. He was evil personified. I had nightmares about it afterwards. How did she have such clarity on one meeting walking in the door? Because she was absolutely right.
He was a bit of a weirdo, we now know.
Now, horribly for her, more details have come out about Epstein's relationship with Bill Gates. There's lots of photos of them together, and there's a draft email that Epstein wrote to Gates, and I think himself, where he said that he'd had to do all manner of things as Bill Gates' right-hand man, that he had had to procure him drugs because he had slept with Russian girls and got an STD and was going to try to slip antibiotics on the sly to Melinda. When she's asked about it on NPR, her eyes kind of brim up. She says that we're having a reckoning as a society, that no girl should ever be put in the situation they were put in by Epstein and all of the various people he had around him. She said it's personally hard, it's heartbreaking for her. It brings back memories of very, very painful times in my marriage. She says she's moved on and she's in a beautiful place. But if there are any questions remaining, they're not for her. I can't even begin to know all of it. She says these questions are for those people and even my ex-husband to answer and not me. And I'm so happy to be away from all the muck that was there. She said it was unbelievable sadness and it meant for her that she had to leave her marriage. And Bill Gates has denied these allegations and said they're untrue. So let's talk about what has been dumped. We've been waiting a long time, as we know, the Department of Justice has overstepped their deadline for having a massive dump of documents. What did you notice about it this week?
What struck me was the atomizing of the focus on Donald Trump, because yes, he's been under all sorts of, you know, kind of controversy with invasions into Venezuela. You've got actions in Iran and Minnesota, and mm-hmm. people have been saying, hang on, what about the Epstein files? Now,
well, Joe Rogan said that what was happening in Minnesota was to cover up for
Tim Walz said exactly the same thing, right? You know, you've got this massive controversy happening in Minnesota, and people are meanwhile going, what about the Epstein files? Now, these files are released as part of the Epstein Files Transparency Act, so they don't just kind of willy-nilly go and kind of dump things on the internet. They've been going through the Department of Justice process.
Or do they?
Or do they? We'll get to that. A process by which yes. things are redacted, things are blacked out.
500 people crawling
a very opaque process.
Yep.
But what they've then dumped is this massive trove of documents, 5,300 files, 38,000 references to Donald Trump alone, his wife Melania, their Mar-a-Lago estate. And what it does is also drag in a whole bunch of other people as well, right? Because part of this whole episode has been about Donald Trump trying to say, I wasn't friends with Epstein. We were friends for a time, and then I distanced myself from him too.
Didn't go to the island.
Exactly.
There was a suggestion made by Trevor Noah at the Grammys that, you know, that the reason he'd wanted Greenland is because he didn't have Epstein's island anymore. And Trump, of course, says that's completely untrue. He never went to the island, and he's threatening to sue.
So, but I want to like go through some of the names that have been mentioned in this latest dump of files. Elon Musk, Bill Gates, as you mentioned, Casey Wasserman, the president of the committee for the 2028 Summer Olympics in LA, the former Israeli PM Ehud Barak, Bill Clinton's former secretary for the Treasury, Larry Summers, Trump's commerce secretary, Howard Lutnick, Google co-founder and billionaire Sergey Brin, Steve Bannon, Miroslav Lajcak, the national security advisor to the Slovakian prime minister, the magician David Copperfield, Sarah Ferguson, former wife of Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor.
Noam Chomsky,
Norway's crown princess Mette Marit. Both of those women, we knew they had associations with Epstein previously, but it's now been revealed they were much deeper, for all these people, much deeper than previously known. So what it's done for me, I think, is just atomize the kind of sense of blame and suspicion about this upper echelon of society. Now, all of these people, their names appear in the files, but it's not like there are allegations or evidence specifically against them. It's just that they appear in the same room, in the same conversation. Their names come up on the sidelines of discussions with Jeffrey Epstein. So no allegations directly of wrongdoing by them, but the association has a bit of a stench about it for
it
anyone
does.
Who's mentioned.
I think we have to be careful that someone's name comes up. This was a guy who was a mover and a shaker and worked on connections.
And pursued famous people, right?
Yes, pursue them. That's right. And often big-noted himself and, you know, obviously traded on connections in this world and how powerful and the people he knew from the president of Mongolia to Prince Andrew, you know. So just because you've been mentioned, like former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, does not mean that there's anything inappropriate or unethical or mm-hmm. wrong that's gone on. And in fact, Kevin Rudd said there was a meeting that was lined up, but it never actually came to fruition. Now, so you're right, Jez, this is basically looking at everything prosecutors have accumulated since Epstein first came into their sights, this was in 2005, of allegations of abusing underage girls in Florida. And there have been two criminal investigations between 2006 and 2019. Now, he's been on the sex offender registry since 2008. But we're also getting his clients' financial documents and all these emails and text messages. None of what we've seen so far fundamentally changes our understanding of really the story. But it gives us more colour, a better understanding of like the culture in which this was fomented, in which it appears to be sex trafficking was overlooked and enabled.
Accepted.
Yeah. And this given other names.
One of the most horrific things to me is the very poor quality of the redactions in these documents. We need to talk about this because the numbers of victims who've been identified, I think the New York Times identified 40 instances
yep.
of people, victims of sexual abuse, who are clearly identifiable in these photographs.
Well, there were 40 unredacted nude images
yep.
of women or teenagers whose faces were shown. How did that happen?
And then there are weird things where someone's name is redacted from one document.
But not the other.
Not the other document. So you can obviously identify them. And so the media has been going to the Department of Justice and saying, hey, you might want to rethink.
Yeah, have a look at this.
And so they're taking files back, redacting them.
Yeah.
And then putting them back out again.
Well, there were 300 Epstein survivors who filed a request from lawyers saying we want an immediate takedown of the website hosting the Epstein materials. There were other survivors who said she had confidential conversations with FBI investigators that had been dumped, not redacted. Why would that be the case? So I think that goes to the fact that these women are generally disregarded in this whole thing anyway. And there's a sloppiness to it. There's also a sloppiness, can I just add as a minor point, there are so many typos in these emails.
Oh, yeah. So
between
many.
These powerful men, like reading any of them, it's going sick, 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 sick. Like literally,
yeah.
Oh, I'm not even getting to grammar.
There's a really important principle when we report on victims of crime that we don't identify them, that we protect their identities and make sure their welfare is looked after in the pursuit of justice, in the exposure of information. When we're shining light on these things, we don't just put everything out there. There's a responsibility on media. There's a responsibility on government to do the same thing, and that has not been adhered to here.
Not at all, and it exposes them completely. I mean, this has been the case throughout. Imagine publishing a nude photo with a face unredacted. Would you do that if the photo had been of Bill Gates, Larry Summers? Would that have still occurred? There's something in the way the asymmetry of power, in the way these women don't have money. Were often quite vulnerable, we know from a lot of the survivors' stories, came from like difficult homes, tough backgrounds, needed some kind of support, and that was exploited. And it feels like it still kind of is.
Does this absolve Donald Trump? Because as I say, this has atomized the blame among so many people. There are so many more questions. There's this massive cloud of uncertainty of what actually happened. Donald Trump has been investigated, according to the Department of Justice. And
has it been fully investigated?
They have found no cause to prosecute, right? How much do we trust the Department of Justice since the clean out by Donald Trump? We don't know. But part of Donald Trump's kind of pursuit here is to claim his innocence and to distance himself from Jeffrey Epstein, but to also express that, like Melinda Gates, but maybe later, he started to have doubts about that friendship with Jeffrey Epstein. Does this, in your mind, somewhat absolve him of a direct connection to Jeffrey Epstein, of allegations of wrongdoing, that he came to some sort of clarity about that relationship, and that he has, although delayed, facilitated the release of these documents?
Couple of points. First, a lot of things have been kept out and redacted.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that is the case for Donald Trump particularly. There's long going to be a sense that we don't know the full story.
And there were some very serious allegations against him particularly, right?
Oh, look, that's the other thing. So some of the allegations they've included have not been vetted in any way and are quite wild. Like journalists aren't even printing it, involving people calling up the hotline that they had and saying, you know, suggestions of murder of babies being witnessed, all this kind of like crazy stuff, right? So it's hard to weigh a lot of this. And that to me is the problem with it. Who has been weighing and assessing this evidence? And why are we getting it dumped in this such sporadic way? And why was it never fully properly investigated in the first place? Another thing to keep in mind is that, yes, they were close friends. There was a lot of proximity between them. We know about a birthday card. They spoke about secrets of love of beautiful women, of all those kinds of things. But Epstein grew to loathe Donald Trump and want to bring him down. So he's not reliable in some senses as well. To me, I think a lot of people will worry about it because like the boxer Ryan Garcia, he's got more than 1 million followers on social media and he's been a huge supporter of Trump. He recently posted on X, "This is my public declaration and announcement. I'm reclining my past support for Donald Trump. Anyone that was involved in anything to do with that island and what they were doing, I just can't support in any way. Children need to be protected. Everyone knew better." But I think in many ways, this is a story that's broader than this, about a whole group of men in elite society who are untouchable, who interfere in global politics, who amass billions of dollars through connections, and who manage historically to escape prosecution for things other people would go down for. And that is a culture that we really need to scrutinise, because it's horrifying, frankly, to see the way they speak to each other, the way they speak to women so lightly, the way they kind of trade secrets. So we do know, by the way, that Bill and Hillary Clinton have now agreed to testify. That's been quite an ongoing process, but they're going to testify in the House Oversight Committee investigation.
Which is a bipartisan committee. They were afraid that this was going to be some kind of witch hunt, which would basically land them in jail, mm-hmm. which is something that Donald Trump has long pursued.
Yes, but there was going to be a vote of contempt against them and they didn't have the numbers, and now they have to do it. But they've asked that it be made public so that they don't just get little excerpts that are then twisted. It is almost unprecedented for a former president to be testifying here. That hasn't happened since 1983. And Donald Trump, remember, did not do that when he was subpoenaed for January 6. So when we talk about what it is culturally, we're also watching it. Like, there's a lot of roiling and actually consequences in Britain. Have you been watching what's happened there?
Lord Mandelson?
Yeah.
Yes. What struck me about him is his quite staunch resistance to any sense of a cloud being around him and whether he should step down or not.
I was fascinated when he was being asked about this on an interview. He kept saying, there was a system that did not protect these girls. There was a system that let them down. It's like, dude.
You are the system.
That's you. Mirror, yes. My friend.
Hello. Yeah.
Yeah. But just to say there's this abstract thing and I couldn't possibly have known. But the Peter Mandelson stuff is actually quite shocking. Former ambassador to the US. He'd already been recalled as ambassador.
Member of the House of Lords.
Yeah, but now he's been forced to resign from both the Labor Party and the House of Lords. And now Prime Minister Starmer has ordered an investigation into him. And Scotland Yard has confirmed he's being investigated on suspicion of misconduct in public office. And that's got a maximum sentence of life imprisonment. And it's not about the photos. There are some odd photos of him in underwear next to women in bathrobes and so on. But it's how compromised he was politically. Forwarding to Epstein this confidential information when he was business secretary under Prime Minister Gordon Brown. Saying he was trying to change government policy on bankers' bonuses, advising Epstein on how JP Morgan, who were his bankers, should mildly threaten the UK Chancellor. He told him about a £500 billion bailout package for the euro the day before it was announced. And then this weird stuff that Epstein made payments to Mandelson, $75,000 US, in three separate transactions in 2003, 2004, he says he has no recollection of that whatsoever. And weirdly, £10,000 to his partner, Ronaldo Avila da Silva, I think to do some course. I mean, it's kind of like the Sarah Ferguson thing. These are small amounts for these wealthy men. So I think that is deeply problematic when it comes to actual policy, but it's also come back to Australian politics, Jez.
Well, Epstein was trying to get together with the former Norwegian Prime Minister Torbjørn Jagland in February of 2016 and invite Kevin Rudd along. And this is how his name pops up in these files. This was at a home in Strasbourg. Kevin Rudd says he never went there. He always felt a bit funny about Epstein and kept a distance. But his name does appear repeatedly because, as we've said before, Jeffrey Epstein pursued famous and influential people.
But you know what? But you know what actually really troubles me when it comes to Australia is Mandelson emailing Epstein, UK, to the US about a campaign against the Rudd government's proposed mining super profits tax, which you remember, the massive campaign against it.
Mm-hmm.
It would have taxed super profits, you know, reaped by mining companies at 40%, like a sovereign wealth fund that
this
we see in European countries.
Money that would have gone to healthcare and education in Australia. I mean, this really does.
9 billion a year.
Actually, at this point, it
Nine
starts
billion.
To affect
yeah.
how you and I live, just regular citizens live, the sort of healthcare and education we receive, our children receive, right? So this is actually
men,
like directly related
yes.
to our lives.
Yes. 9 billion a year it was supposed to raise. So that mining tax was replaced with a watered-down version. Tony Abbott cancelled it, dead in the water, right? But Mandelson was talking about the advice that he was giving as to how to run a campaign against this tax. You know, why don't you start to accept there's no ideological reason why the industry shouldn't be making a greater contribution to society, given the constrained economic times, but this should be done on the basis of fairness and then seek a compromise. Why Mandelson is telling Epstein, we don't know. it's kind of a concern. And then it's also weird when there's text messages when Steve Bannon, we remember, chief strategist of Donald Trump, especially in the 2016 campaign, boasts to Epstein about having a hand in Clive Palmer's $60 million election ad campaign in 2019. This is the text from Bannon. I had Clive Palmer do the $60 million anti-China and anti-climate change ads. And there's an implication that it's part of a wider plan there to kind of disrupt global democracy. So a spokesperson for Mr. Palmer says he'd never spoken to Bannon, and we have no evidence that they ever met or communicated with Bannon or Epstein. I don't know. But we do know that this exchange occurred. During the 2019 election, when there was all that discussion about disrupting mainstream parties, climate policy, international institutions. So it's kind of quite disconcerting that we see Australia get involved into this, not because of it's a sex trafficking network, but because
the external influence that's being exercised on policy in Australia, based on a connection in an alleged sex trafficking ring.
And I should mention, so Palmer didn't win any seats there, but he actually claimed credit for the Morrison government's victory because of the UAP's 3.5% primary vote, along with its preferences votes,
that flow on,
especially in Queensland. So Labor had a post-election review and they said the magnitude of Palmer's expenditure crowded out Labor's advertising in broadcast, print and digital media, and his entry as a high-wealth individual willing to outspend the entire ALP was a new and destabilising factor. So, Jez, our question is now, where to from here and what are our takeouts from this?
Well, there's one person in jail. For all of this, despite all the lists that have been produced about people who could be potentially prosecuted, one person is in jail.
Mm.
It's Ghislaine Maxwell.
Yes.
And apart from that, just a whole bunch of allegations with patchy evidence and a deep stench.
And you can see that they drew up who were his lieutenants. It cannot be just Ghislaine Maxwell who knew about all of this. This sense that we're just getting, here's this information, you work out what it means, and there hasn't been a forensic body that we can really trust to go through it, I think is very disconcerting. I think there'll be a very deep sense of unease about this clubby coziness, emails back and forth, here's global politics, and then the next email will say female genitalia is carb-free, so it's fine to have. Here's something else about a Russian woman you should have dinner with. She's 26, really trustworthy, literally sending women over to each other. Noam Chomsky, you know, the great intellect, giving him advice, saying he's been under fire himself and you just got to, you know, for things in the past, the best way to proceed is ignore it. That's particularly true now with the hysteria that's developed about abuse of women, which has reached the point that even questioning a charge is a crime worse than murder. Now, you can see the back padding and the upholding of powerful men. So I think all of these things are really, I mean, that's why I started off this podcast is going, I am fired up about this. I think the disregard, you can see no one really cares about the women in this, centres them. They mostly don't have names.
As we're recording this, Jules, on Wednesday morning, a judge in New York is about to consider that application by those 300 women to redact those files, for the DOJ to take back the files. I mean, it just seems far too late for that. Media organisations have decided not to identify those people, publish those photos, but it's now out there. I don't really know what the way forward is here.
I really would like this to be calmly and rigorously assessed, and there is going to be a lot of noise around this. There is going to be, oh no, someone bumped into Epstein at a party, you know, 20 years ago. Therefore, he's but very serious crimes have been committed here. That's different to a cozy kind of men's club. We've been told a lot of lies. Prince Andrew went on television and did not tell the truth about the last time he spoke to or saw Jeffrey Epstein. And there have been consequences for that. Women have had a different take, quite clearly. The thing that troubles me more than anything probably is we're at a time of great eroding trust in everything, in governments, in systems, in media. And how can this not be a shot in the arm for every conspiracy theorist who thinks there are people immune from the law who just look after their own interests and conceal things like global pedophile networks. That to me is why we need to keep asking for answers on this and accountability. Okay, Jez, it's also been the Grammys.
A lot of good songs this year. I have to say, sometimes I look at the Grammys and I go, I don't know these people, I don't know these songs. This year, a lot of really good songs, but a really critical time politically for the US. Yes. And this really interesting thing, you know, we were talking last week about whether tennis players should be probed about their political views. This was the Grammys and big music stars getting up on stage and making political statements, in particular about ICE, with a few expletives. What I think I liked about it when people got up to speak was that people, it was not really about them. People like Kehlani, Bad Bunny, got up and spoke about the fact they are from stock of immigrants. They are part of a long line of people who have come from immigrant backgrounds, who have basically gone to the US, the land of the free, to hustle. And this is where it's got them to the stage of the Grammys. Yeah, this is what the American story is meant to be about.
America.
Right?
So Bad Bunny's saying, when he said ICE out, but he goes, we're not savage. We're not animals, we're not aliens, we are humans and we are Americans. So he dedicated his award to all the people who had to leave their homeland, their country, to follow their dreams, which is not the way it's been cast in recent times. And I do love that he also cautioned people to not be drawn into hate and remember that you're fueled by love, love of your people, love of your family.
Shabuzi talked about his mother who said, as of today, has retired from her job after 30 years working in the medical field as a registered nurse in a psych ward. She worked 3 to 4 jobs just to provide for me and my siblings as an immigrant in this country. Immigrants built this country, literally, actually. So this is for them, all children of immigrants. I just love the sense of heritage on stage. I mean, can you think about all those families? If they had a window to the future to see their child, their grandchild, great-grandchildren
standing
on the
stage
of the Grammys, what an incredible thing for America to provide them.
Yeah.
Billie Eilish got up on stage. She's been getting some quite serious backlash because she got up on stage and she made this speech that's been variously described as the rant of a lefty pop star. So in her acceptance speech, she said, as grateful as I am, I don't feel like I need to say anything, but no one is illegal on stolen land. It's really hard to know what to say and do right now, and I feel really hopeful in this room. I feel like we just need to keep fighting and speaking up and protesting. And she concluded by saying, F ICE. That's all I'm going to say. Sorry. Thank you so much. Now, the right-wing media and commentators and the like have been really trolling her because she owns a multi-million dollar mansion in a gated community in a part of LA that's recognized as being part of the traditional lands of the Tongva people. So people are saying, well, Billy, if you really believe that, hand your mansion back. And you're seeing this kind of split in the entertainment industry in the US of people who dare to speak out and people calling them out for it. And what it's reminded me is that for all the uproar we're seeing in Minnesota and other places around the country and the operations of ICE, there is still a significant body of support in America for what ICE is doing.
I think it's an interesting turning point in a way because celebrities have felt somewhat chastised after the last election.
It's the whole stay in your lane thing, right?
Well, there's been a conventional wisdom that you guys didn't help Kamala Harris, you harmed it. While Trump was out, you know, like working at McDonald's and...
and saying drain the swamp.
Getting amongst people. Yep. There was a sense of, of elites who we know people are very, very suspicious of. But I did think when I saw Billie Eilish say, our voice does matter and people do matter, whether we'll begin to see more celebrities speaking out because they feel compelled to or because actually people like Bad Bunny are worried about having concerts because they will be targeted by ICE. Jez, it's time for Pick of the Week.
Okay, Jules, I want to read you a tribute to the late actor Catherine O'Hara. Oh,
the great.
Renowned, beloved, award-winning Canadian-American actor. She died last week at the age of 71. A 50-year career on screen, which, I mean, anyone who can hold a career down of any sort for 50 years, More power to you.
Right.
An amazing woman. But I came across this tribute. There are many tributes of what she meant to entertainment and what she meant to people individually. And I came across this one kind of from left field because it was written by a non-binary Muslim filmmaker from India, Faraz Arif Ansari. It was one of the most beautifully written tributes, and I want to read it to you. I keep thinking about how Catherine O'Hara somehow managed to mother an entire generation of queer people without ever announcing it, without ever claiming it, without ever trying. She just did it, casually, in wigs, with impeccable timing. Even when she wasn't playing someone queer, she was playing people who lived sideways, who didn't apologize for their cadence, their drama, their excess, their inconvenient emotional honesty. And as a queer kid watching from the edges, that mattered a lot. Representation isn't about labels. Sometimes it's about recognition. And I recognized myself in her refusal to shrink. And that monologue, you know the one, the take 1,000 nude photos of yourself while you still can speech. I laughed. I clutched my chest. I felt deeply attacked and deeply healed in under 30 seconds. Because only Catherine could deliver a line like that and make it about self-love, impermanence, desire, grief, vanity, mortality, and joy all at once. Like saying, your body is not a problem to be solved. It's a moment. Witness it. Catherine O'Hara didn't just make me laugh, she made me feel safe for being strange. She made queerness feel expansive, not defensive. Thank you for the wigs, for the timing, for the permission, for the reminder to take the damn photo. It is such a beautiful tribute, isn't it?
Yeah, that's perfect.
And I think it's a reminder too for me that, you know, I think one of the greatest things you can do for a person is to put into words in front of all the people who love them, the impact and the space that they occupied in the world. And this is what that does. Even if they barely had any contact with each other, I think they met once and lived on opposite sides of the world, but impact is large. And I think it's such a great tribute to how we can take inspiration from elsewhere who live different lives, but who say and stand for something that mean something
very
personal.
There's so much conformity now.
Yeah.
Like so many actors are literally making their faces look the same as each other. Their bodies look the same as each other. One other thing I just want to quickly note that I loved about her and about Moira in particular from Schitt's Creek was the use of language. Yes. Stop being such a disgruntled penguin, which is what I'm going to call you from now on if you're a little upset. Disgruntled penguin.
Anyway, Jules, that's my pick. What's yours?
Okay. This is one of the best names I've ever heard in real life. I want to talk about a 13-year-old boy called Austin Appleby.
Oh, he's going to be a superstar.
He
I
is.
Know it. Oh, is he right?
He is. Let me tell you why. So he's off the, you know, the coast of Perth, you know, yeah.
Yes.
Quindalup.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep. Near Busselton, wild seas. He's out with his mother, kayak, paddleboard, two of his siblings. And they start getting swept out in rough seas and they just are getting swept further and further out.
Oh, I've got chills just listening
to
this.
He's trying to kayak them to shore. He tries to pull them. He can't do it. His mother finally makes this grueling decision and says, you're going to have to go and get help. That 13-year-old boy swam 4 kilometres in rough seas. At one point he said, I could see something under me. That's so sharky, that area. And the first 2 kilometres, which took 2 hours, was with a life jacket on, which he then chucked it off, decided he'd be quicker to get there. He then reached the beach, had to sprint for 2 kilometres and say, my family needs help. He was like, we need a chopper, we need a boat, we need all the help we can get. My family's been swept out to sea. He then went and some lovely woman on the beach gave him something to eat. He then passed out apparently. He's now on crutches because he, you know, that's like running a marathon essentially. And he just said, he kept saying to himself, not today. Not today. I'm just going to make it through. Not today. Am I giving up? Right. And they went out, all the forces were activated, and they found his mother and his 2 siblings 14 kilometres out to sea.
And the sun had already gone
down
by this stage.
The waves were huge.
Yeah.
And when the boat finally got to them, one of the kids had actually been thrown off and she couldn't hear him anymore. So it was like a massive relief. So what a story. I mean, we've just been talking about extraordinary or extreme altruists, but This is a plucky kid who drew on every ounce of strength and beyond that he possessed to save his family. I think it's incredible.
I didn't remember his name, but I know the story. And my God, that the thing that's been ringing in my head since I heard it was not today. Not today.
Not today.
What a mantra for every day for all of us.
Yes.
Not today.
Yes. So anyway, shout out to all, honestly, the Austin Applebees among us. You know, he was called on that day and he gave it everything he had. Like he woke up, he didn't even know if they were safe or not. Like what a moment. What a thing to have done. I just think it's incredible.
Here's to the Austin Applebees and Catherine O'Hara's of the world.
Exactly. Exactly. Lovely to see you, Jez.
Our producers are Madeline Jenner and Cinema Nipper. Jules, catch you again soon.
Bye.
See you, doll.